Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Robots of Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have my friend Daniel Schmidt with me here today. Daniel, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Nick. I'm really happy we're getting an opportunity to chat. Yeah, this is great. I'm excited.
As am I, man. As am I. We've been going back and forth with you together, talking them for like a couple months now. I think you've had a I think you changed positions since we initially spoke, which is awesome. Congratulations on the new role. So for
Thank you,
everybody
sir.
that yeah, man, for everybody that doesn't have the opportunity, hasn't had the opportunity to know you or get to know you yet, do you mind just telling folks a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here, man? What you do? What's your story?
Yeah, gladly. So thank you, Nick. First things first. Again, it's been a pleasure to go and chat with you over the last couple of weeks. And yeah, I'm really excited for this conversation. I think we'll talk about some interesting stuff. So I guess a little bit on my background. I originally came from or originally kind of like started my academic career in math and physics, and then went and ran up against quantum mechanics and decided that's not what I want to do anymore. And no, and again, like, didn't have too much direct comp sci experience at the time beyond like kind of like specific foundational like computational programming type courses, and ended up finishing, doing my undergrad in applied math with a minor in physics. And then kind of like towards the end of my undergrad, I decided that probably going and switching to a more like comp sci related direction was probably be very helpful. And that's when I shifted directly and discovered machine learning, which became kind of like a passion of mine since. So went and then conducted my master's in CS with specifically with a focus in reinforcement learning. Underwent some really, I'd say, decently interesting research in going and solving Atari games using reinforcement learning agents. By now, using some like asynchronous actor critic type implementations, by now there are many more sophisticated methods. So after I finished my education, I'm as some of the viewers may tell, I have a bit of an accent. So I'm a dual US Israeli citizen. So after I finished my education, I went back to Israel. I went through my mandatory military service, where thanks to my background, I went and served in the field, specifically doing like AI and algorithm development and research in the IDF. It was mostly, I'd say, a very good kind of like technical environment to go and properly hone in my technical skills. And since then, I've been involved in this data science, machine learning, AI space for about 13 years in a couple of different domains, and everything from security to media to transportation to healthcare, and now a lot in government. And historically, my core kind of area of focus was in computer vision, but I, over the last couple of years, obviously, I've been more interested in and more focused in NLP, like a lot of the research community. And at the moment, I'm working at Thomson Reuters Special Services, which is essentially like the government department. It's a US-based like government subsidiary of the larger Thomson Reuters. And I'm working again. I'm not going to go into too much depth on everything that I'm working on, but we're working on some pretty cool kind of like multi-agent frameworks for, in particular, for like deep research type implementations. But yeah, I'm having a lot of fun, and
Awesome,
goes without saying, as we're going to go into this conversation, obviously it's very relevant because it requires keeping up to date with where the research community is doing, including conducting some of our own kind of like novel research. So
Absolutely. Yeah, man. No, I really appreciate that. And thank you so much for coming on, Daniel. It's absolutely a pleasure to have you. And
thank you for having me.
yeah, man. And today we're talking about, to your point, which we're talking about the speed of development, the speed of change within AI, but specifically not from that side, but from a practitioner side. So as a practitioner, what skills are important, right? And how do you make sure that you're maintaining relevancy as things continue to evolve? So, I mean, before we even get into that, how do you even define like staying up to date within this field, considering how fast everything is changing?
Yeah, that is a great question. So let's, again, like you mentioned, let's try to phrase what it means to stay up to date, and then afterwards we'll think of a couple of I guess a couple of rules of thumb or standard practices for how I would think would be effective to go and to stay up to date. So, staying up to date as far as I define, and again, we're gonna caveat everything by saying that we're my area of expertise more so than anything is in software, right? So I'm keeping out of the loop the whole discussion on like areas that are much closer to hardware. I have worked a bit on hardware optimization in edge devices for some ML pipelines, but that is really not my area of expertise. So I'm gonna keep that out of the conversation. We'll see
Absolutely.
where we're gonna go. But it goes without saying, even in the software space, in many cases and for many solutions, right? As long as you have kind of like a good business case and good use case and understanding of what it is that you're trying to develop. And in many cases, you might not even strictly need like the most sophisticated techniques, right? Like you can solve a lot of things using traditional software or using like statistical approaches, classical machine learning models, deep learning, and then now like Gen AI and agentic systems. So just by my very nature, I like to start relatively simple. Right, as I try to structure a solution. And if I find that the proof of concept that I'm developing is missing some level of, and obviously this is in the system design phase, right? If it feels to me like it's missing some functionality that is key for the system, then you revisit things and you up the level of complexity. But having that said, let's think about how you keep up to date with this type of really sophisticated, or I don't know, really sophisticated, but mostly very fast-moving, fast-paced type of landscape. So I think that the best way to describe what it means to be up to date is to have a decent enough understanding as to what the state of the art, and then maybe a bit less than that, methodologies are for solving certain types or certain classes of problems, right? So it goes without saying, let's assume that we have decided that we're looking to solve a particular problem using some sort of machine learning approach, right? And this can be traditional machine learning, supervised, unsupervised, or reinforcement based, or like new Gen AI techniques, right? It usually is very, very helpful to have a decent understanding of the relevant machine learning tasks that you're looking at, and kind of like what the recommended state of the art or the good enough kind of like implementation out there is in across the research community. Just for example, right? Again, let's start simple, right? If you're trying to identify, for example, insights from video or from images, that would mean maybe getting a good understanding of what the best or what the current state of the art is, both in research and in technical metrics in things like image classification, object detection, object tracking, and the like. And that is decently simple to identify, right? I mean, there's a lot of aggregators out there, like there's TLDR, AlphaSignal. Obviously Hugging Face is excellent for this type of stuff. For Gen AI stuff, you have like LangChain or LangGraph related communities. So it's a matter of there's Papers with Code, which is really good also on a task level component. But essentially that's what it means to go and to have a to be, at least in my point of view, to be up to date with regards to where the community is in solving a particular problem. So there's that, and then I already explored some of the tools, but just a recommendation, and this is something that we'll probably get back to a couple of times throughout this conversation, is since there is so much information out there, right, I would recommend for people to, and that's something that I do, right, to try to plug into various what I like to call passive sources or passive aggregators of information. So maybe some of the blogs that we mentioned earlier really depends a lot on each person's preferred way of learning things, right? So maybe you have people who are more or pick up things better from going and reading, and you have people who are maybe keener by listening to podcasts or I don't know, viewing like YouTube tutorials or whatever it takes. it's I identify the best way for you to learn something, and then pair that with some prototyping and experimentation time, because I find that that is usually very, very helpful to actually learn and retain information.
Absolutely, man. No, I really appreciate that. I love the sources you gave. I think a lot of them are obviously gold standards of the industry. But and obviously for folks like yourself doing cutting edge research, I think or working on the bleeding edge, I think that's absolutely right. And how do you think that how would somebody like myself stay up to date, or who's an executive in a company or an end user? Like, because I think that those are going to be very different tools and resources. I think obviously there's the building of the building stuff on your side. For how does it change when you're a user and you're just trying to get the most value out of the tool, and what do you, how does staying up to date change there?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. And obviously, maybe I should have prefaced what I was saying, right, by
Hey,
mentioning that I was, no, I mean it's a great question, right? That
man.
I was coming at it a bit of a lot more from the practitioner point of view, right? So obviously, if you're an executive or if you are an edge user, or you want to be a more, I guess, a more thoughtful, even a more thoughtful consumer of whatever's out there, right? Given that the great majority of services nowadays that you would run into, certainly on the web, they have a lot of machine learning components, either recommender systems or a lot of or essentially everywhere you'll go, you'll run into these types of systems. So I think getting a high level understanding of how they utilize how the these systems utilize data. So for example, if you're a user, understanding that your personal information is relevant for how the system is going to interact with you, right, is really pretty key. If you want to be kind of more of a power user, or again, if you want to lead teams of engineers, then usually or frequently benefits to have a bit of a kind of like a longer term or a higher foot view of kind of like larger trends of where the industry is going. So for example, just to make it a little bit more tangible, right? Now and it was interesting because I thought about bringing it up in a later question, but I think it's a good place to add it. We've been seeing a lot of MCP implementations across the board. MCP, for those who don't know, there it's a short form for Model Context Protocol, which is essentially like an open standard, and people like to use the analogy of like a USB-C for LLM based applications. So the nice thing is that it's a great bit of progress from Anthropic, where essentially the idea is to save developers the effort to go and interact with all the varying APIs out there, right, which all have kind of like a different structure to interact with. But the nice thing there is these types of implementations are actually much more aligned towards the more of the end user and also the executive, because they're trying to abstract away a lot of the technical minutiae and the technical details for the sake of larger scale system design and larger scale discussion of direct functionality. So if you want to be a particular power user, in many of these cases, you can just pay for it or something like a cloud subscription and boot up like Cloud Desktop, and all of a sudden with MCPs you have this sea of available and really lightweight automations that you can that anybody as a layperson can set up. For executives, goes without saying, maybe instead of viewing all those sources that I mentioned, maybe things like summaries or maybe like curated reports, certainly more like internal organization reports, and establishing kind of like a core corporate strategy within the organization. Like that would be areas that they'd be more focused on. And goes without saying, both providing direction and empowering your technical professionals to go and try to align as best they can with your vision. That's the kind of the key of any software executive.
Yeah, man. No, I know, like for me, I'm across a lot of different industries, and so how I go about it is first, I will a lot of the times I'll just ask different LLMs how to work with them, right? because it's generative system and as a language model, I'm able to ask it things like that, right? I also, from like studying prompt engineering and how best to get the best, how to get the best results, right, is as I'll iterate back and forth between two systems, whether it's like a Claude and a ChatGPT or a ChatGPT and a Bard, and I'll throw things back and forth between them and to try to refine it. But also, like, personally, I think like places like Reddit has some great prompt engine, and not super technical, but from like a prompt engineering and a large line, like understanding how they work, super helpful is what I found. Like, I also learn by doing, right? That's my learning style. I don't do well in classrooms. I don't do well in I do really I don't do well like just watching things. I need to actually functionally do something with it for it to really stick with me. So I think those are great sources. I also think like I don't when like I have a guy that works for me who he's phenomenal. He's amazing. And I like he's like you and him, like he when DeepSeek came out with their stuff, he read all of their research papers, right? Every single one of them, and understood them, and because that's the level of technical understanding he needs. I don't need to I can't understand things at that level because I don't have the fundamental basis of knowledge that folks like yourself and he do, because you've been doing it for years and years and years and years and years. But I can have conversations and learn, and like doing things like this absolutely helps me. And then also, yeah, I think just getting out there and playing with it is super helpful. But staying up to date and super up to date on all the cutting edge stuff is overwhelming. How do you cut through some of that noise, Daniel?
Yeah, for sure. So before I get to that, you covered a lot of great things, Nick, and I'd like to address
Of
them really
course.
quickly. So on the conversation piece, I think you're doing exactly the right thing, and also you're yeah, I mean, I think you get unique perspectives, and we mentioned the different personas who would interact with these types of systems. I think even as a maybe especially as a practitioner, goes without saying that speaking with people from different perspectives and different needs, I think gets you to understand very, understand better where it is that you'd like to go, right? And it helps you to prevent the kind of maybe like miss the forest for the trees kind of thing when you're very tied into specific when you're really zoning in and focusing in on specific technical details of the implementation. So that is great. Even strictly on a knowledge sharing perspective, you can learn a lot more by having a quick conversation with people. Again, provided that they're nice and open and a pleasure to speak with, like yourself. And no, seriously, and you can pick up a lot of information that way as well. That's a totally valid and useful form of, and obviously makes the work more fun, which is always great. On your point on prompting is 100% correct. I would recommend for people who are anybody who interacts with these systems, which I think is most people, certainly everybody who's listening in, but just about almost everybody now, right? Just go and interact with ChatGPT or whatever other provider. A very low-hanging fruit way to actually improve the performance of what you end up getting with these systems is properly learning how to prompt. And there is a reason why there are prompt engineers now. Obviously, nobody, like, as a layperson, you don't have to get to that level, but there are very low-hanging fruit prompt templates that people can, I mean, we can share some links, but goes without saying, looking up prompt templates. Essentially, in many cases, it looks something like you request the LLM to identify itself as a certain persona, right? And then you make the ask very, very clear. And if possible, you provide a couple of examples, right? It's called one shot or few shot examples. And there are very specific ways of doing that, but that ends up improving the output performance immensely, usually, as opposed to going and asking something that's not super clear. And goes without saying, I share and agree with you 100% on the part of the staying up to date is going and getting a good sense of what each provider is seemingly focusing on. So Also, on my end, I work primarily with OpenAI, so with ChatGPT, and then with Claude in particular for a lot of like or historically for a lot of like code implementations. I don't want to say vibe code because that's a bit of a contentious topic, but I have a coding assist set up using RuCode, which is a VS Code plugin that is set up with Claude 3.7, and that works very, very well. Recently, I've been experimenting more and more with Gemini. They have their 2.5 experimental, which is insane. And just a few days ago, Facebook came out, I think on Saturday they came out with Llama 4. So we'll wait and see what the community thinks about that. So I just sorry for the tangents. It
Okay,
just
man.
you
We're having a
covered a lot of
conversation
really
today.
interesting stuff. Yeah,
No,
I
I
did as well.
agree. And I think that you're absolutely right about a lot. I think that understanding prompting is huge. And I mean, personally, I haven't done a lot of the persona asking it for specific personas and telling it to pretend you're an expert tax accountant or what have you, right? But I will, like, I never ask for a final product in one shot ever, right? And so I make it iterative, and so I'll ask it, hey, do you know what this is, right? And just as an example, right, like I was working on some past performance documents for a proposal we put in recently, and I asked, we worked as a subcontractor, and I asked it, I had a specific contract number, and I asked it, hey, do you know what this contract is? Awesome, cool. Do you know what they did on it? Okay, how did they do this, right? How would a subcontractor write some past performance if they had these five positions, right? And then when you get all the way down, and then I started plugging in like the re my guy's resumes on it, and had, all right, hey, use this to add additional color, use this to add additional color, use this to add additional color. And the next thing you know, you have this great document, which is still not final, right? Like, let's be clear, nobody should ever be sending out or using anything related to that is just without, like, that is just from an LLM without going through and understanding what it actually says. Because having hired a lot of people recently, I can't tell you how many resumes I've seen where you can tell they didn't proofread it, because it'll be some nice, really great, I mean, pretty well written bullet point, but in it there'll be a bracket and says insert statistic here, or insert and or insert what you did here, and like they just didn't even read it. And it's like, guys, like that's not great, that's less than ideal, right? Like that just makes you look not good entirely. And I think that it's really, I think figuring out how to get through a lot of that is difficult for folks, and especially when you start thinking about understanding how, like, again, as we touched on it earlier, different levels of knowledge needed, right? Like you need a level of technical detail that I personally don't. And so when I come across something like that seems interesting and it's super technical, I'll take it and throw it into an LLM and tell it, hey, what does this mean? What is the technology, right? And have it explain it to me, and see what else I learn outside of reading it, right? Because I think that's one of the things that I like most about it, is it has about this technology and how it's rolled out. Is it's they always used to say that, like, lawyers don't speak English, they speak legal, right? And I think they still say that. They used to too. But as it's like I don't need that anymore. I can take a contract and throw it in and ask for where the problematic areas are without needing that level of understanding. And again, I'm not saying get rid of your attorney. You certainly shouldn't do that. I'm saying that it's a tool you can use to help, because I could tell you from experience, it's always less expensive to ask an attorney to edit something than to create something from scratch.
100%, and there's a lot like I love everything that you mentioned. So first thing saying, I'll do my new employer justice and plug in like DR's CoCounsel, which is the new legal AI assistive technology that can throw in benchmarks. I don't have the numbers directly, but that relates a lot to what you mentioned in terms of going and not getting the legal department out of the loop, but providing a good kind of co-pilot for each organization's legal team. So that relates to that. In terms of throwing things into the LLM and seeing what comes out. I think that that is generally a valid approach. Goes without saying, and that relates to what you mentioned about needing to verify everything that comes out is in many cases these LLMs can hallucinate, which in itself is a bit of a misnomer or a frustrating term, because in classical or like traditional supervised learning, right, like we wouldn't call it strictly hallucination, right? If you were trying to run a supervised learning model outside of its like training distribution, right? It's a generalization failure because your training data wasn't up to the task, right? So,
Right. It's
you know,
a
so
nice way to say system failure, correct?
sure, from a user standpoint, that's the right way to look at it. There are some goes without saying that a lot of the modern systems are not strictly speaking only LLM or freeform LLM generation. I'm sure you're familiar with like retrieval augmented generation and a lot of the more advanced techniques where the LLM is a lot more, and obviously the new like agentic frameworks in which the LLM is essentially the decider or the brain that decides which direction software should move with. So, for example, which capabilities it should utilize, if it should go and run a query against a local database or the wider web, or call a particular tool. But again, that is a whole conversation in itself, which again I'd love to have with you, and we can go into as much depth as we like. What I do want to say, that's the last thing relating to what you mentioned, is your type of back and forth with the LLM is very reminiscent of there's a technique called chain of thought, right? And that is a really well-known or really recommended way of actually getting what you want. And there are a lot of kind of like chatbot or like prompting techniques that fall along the lines. And obviously I would recommend for all of the viewers to get at least decently familiar enough with the thought process behind them, because that would, even as a user, that is a really low-hanging fruit for improving the performance you get from these systems. So
Absolutely, man. No, I appreciate it. And yeah, I always think about it like a pipeline, like a funnel, like a sales funnel, just any kind of funnel. Start with all human knowledge and you narrow it down to, I'm talking about this, and you narrow it down and narrow it down, right? And but just out of curiosity, how do you balance like learning about some of these new AI advancements with actually implementing them in real world projects, and kind of how do you take the theoretical cutting edge and bring it into the real world?
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit, and that actually aligns very, very well with the signal and the noise question that you asked earlier, and that we the conversation kind of sidetracked a little bit. So no, I mean it's great. I'm loving this free form format of the conversation. So first things first, while I am very, very curious about the research, there are a couple of ways to try to understand which project that you're looking at is more mature also from a software standpoint. So just for an obvious example, right, you can look at something like at the actual accompanying code base, right, that you have. Obviously a lot of articles nowadays, a lot of machine learning papers are released with associated code, right? And there's plenty of open source code out there. Goes without saying, if the particular implementation you're looking for or you're looking at has a lot of buzz around it in GitHub, right, or the version control system of your choice, that is a very positive sign, right? Similarly, if there is a lot of buzz around it in various professional forums, be it Stack Overflow or Medium or LinkedIn or any of these sources, that's also a really, really good sign, because the best sign for a mature proof of concept is that people actually use it and interact with it. So that I find to be very, very valuable. And alternatively, if you run into, obviously, as a researcher, if you run into some more niche or some more unique kind of like a research problem without much community involvement, you're going to be in for a rough time in that particular problem. So So that is, I find a nice kind of like down and dirty approach to dealing with it. Goes without saying, in many cases, the actual open source starting point, usually, which you'll get to, can come at varying levels of maturity. In many cases, if it's just a if it's like an academic institution, and not gonna insult any academic institutions in particular, but in many cases, right, the accompanying code is usually, in most cases that I've seen, is usually lower quality than many of those you see in industry, right? And again, I think it's purely because their interest is obviously is in the publishing piece a lot more than, in actually constructing a proper software product. Then you should expect there to be a different or varying levels of effort to actually go and get your proof of concept off the ground, right? In terms of going from that starting point to actually integrating it with your organization's data and having a good place to start. Goes without saying, if you're looking to do something like transfer learning or fine-tuning or everything of the sort, then you're going to need to account for that as well. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really interesting. And thinking about technical practitioners, right? Younger ones coming up now, right? If considering that, there's first, I'm not really sure when the last time new code was written. I think that most people just get it off the internet, right? Like, but second, that part aside, second, right? With the rise of all of these coding tools out there, how should young folks looking to get into this, or career change folks looking to get into this space, how should they approach the importance of understanding of being a good coder, right? How important is that? As we are now, and how important do you think it will be over the next couple of years?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. And I think the answer is, I'm just, again, being honest and transparent. I think the answer is that nobody really knows. And depending who you're going to talk to, they're going to have incredibly varied opinions. You do see some people who are very, certainly all the vibe coding crowd, who are like, oh, all you need is to describe your solution in natural language and you can get a proof of concept off the ground and all that kind of stuff. I'm a bit less bullish than that. I will say that software fundamentals, at least from what I've seen, do matter. And more so than anything, I find that these new all of these tools, and as I mentioned earlier, I use them pretty much continuously, right? They mostly, at least at this point, they feel to me more like productivity boosters as opposed to engineer replacement machines. And there were a couple of projects not too long ago that, and it happens every so often that you have some provider going and claiming that they've solved software engineering and they have like AI coder. I forgot the last big thing, but there are a couple of projects now. OpenAI are looking to do probably something similar with. They want to sell agents for, I don't know, for 20 grand a year or something of the sort that can also assist with coding. But I do think it's certainly important to have a good enough understanding of the fundamentals. So everything from data structures to like kind of like core algorithms to the basics of operating systems to things on the math side, it helps to have like you don't need to get super in depth from it from a developer standpoint, right? Maybe some linear algebra with maybe the a bit of calculus, so a bit of mostly going and figuring out how gradient descent works, which is the core algorithm by which you train these neural networks. Really, that is essentially just partial derivatives, right? Which you learn, I don't know, in something like calculus 2 or calculus 3 in any undergrad program, either in math or computer science or engineering. So goes without saying, if you want to go really deep on the theory, like there are a lot of places that do that. if you you're for anybody who's, I guess we're talking to young people directly, if you or anybody wants to go really deep on the theory, obviously these types of fields are the areas that you're going to want to go deeper in. But if you want to stay on the level of the practitioner, I think we covered a decent foundation there. Yeah, so
Absolutely.
that's pretty much it.
Yeah, man. So I know you've used these tools a lot. What from a performance perspective, when you think about not performance of the system, performance of the code it spits out, how does that vary based on how common the problem you're trying to solve is?
Yeah, so that is a really great question. So, as you can imagine, right, ultimately, and this is something that, almost from a, and that also relates to why in the longer term you can't replace everybody, right? I mean, goes without saying, the obvious elephant in the room, which maybe I should have addressed in our last little back and forth, is there is a lot more to software engineering and to then going in and generating source code. Right, generating source code is only, I'd argue, a fairly small component there. Things like system design and the like are still areas where the systems are not, the automated systems are not quite there. So obviously from a practitioner standpoint, I will say that I find those areas to be more interesting. So I'm enjoying the shift in focus. I don't know if in the next, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, right, that would change and those areas would be covered as well. But specifically in terms of the quality of the source code, obviously that varies a lot. That varies a lot by the model you're using. That varies a lot by the prompting techniques that you use, by essentially what you're offering the model. Again, by how well studied, like you mentioned, how well studied the problem is. Because on some level, and everybody is innately aware of it, but maybe not always thinking about it. But these systems are trained over source code that already exists, right? So all of these providers essentially trained their systems, right, on effectively what is scraped and sometimes illegally scraped source code from version control systems like GitHub, right? So as is perhaps maybe not surprising, right, the generated code is the model has been optimized to generate things that are similar to what it's already seen, right? So if you're looking to solve a problem that is a well-studied problem that is, or at least is similar to something that is very well studied, then you can expect to get good performance from these models. If you're looking to on working on something that is really, really unique, and funnily enough, I find that to be actually a minority of the cases. I find that even for maybe like research or scientific applications, which is where you would expect that type of stuff to be, or I don't know, for medical applications or these types of stuff, I find that the great majority of the time you can find something that is often similar enough to have a good place to start. I am sure that I'm missing some really niche and some really unique applications, but that is certainly in the minority. So.
Yeah, I agree. I think that where there's a lot more out there publicly is going to be obviously trained for more of it, right? But when you start looking at unique implementations or new implementations, like a project we just did at the EPA, we just wrapped up, like nobody in the world has ever deployed this software at such a large scale and in such a complex environment. You're not going to have AI code to do all. It can help with some of it, right? There's some coding bridges, things like that can help with some of it, but yeah, the architecting it all is good. A friend of mine was telling me a couple of months ago that he was able to get to like the they're pretty good when it comes to some problems when you start asking to do like edge cases, anything that's an edge case, however you define an edge case, because that changes industry by industry, implementation by implementation. It like it'll get there eventually, probably, but it takes more time, and also you see your performance of the code is just not good, right? It'll take forever to load because it's working through a very, let's just say, it's working through a non-traditional solution and it's trying to apply traditional methods to it. And so There's absolutely a way to do it, but it is not the best way to do it by any stretch of the imagination. For folks out there that don't understand, it's the equivalent of going to a website and it taking 25 seconds to load, or 30 seconds to load instead of half a second. And I don't know if you got if you know this, but Daniel, we don't really have long attention spans in this world anymore. So
100%, my friend. I will say, and this is, I think your point is really, really important. And again, that relates to also what we talked about in the beginning, that this might not be the best way to solve things. Just to add a bit more color to what you mentioned, right? For things, especially things involving trying to solve things like trying to solve math problems and that type of stuff, it's and that's where getting the very light, low key understanding of how these systems work actually helps the layperson a lot, right? Ultimately, the simple way to look at it is it's these models are probabilistically predicting what the next token will be, right? Based off of a large number of parameters inside that are essentially predicting conditional probabilities on everything in their context window, right? And there's no real, and that's the hope is, right, is within the internal layers of the model, right? But there's no innate understanding of kind of like higher level concepts. That is really an unsolved research problem. You do get some thinking models which essentially just in most cases just go and do something like a chain of thought internally. So they get intermediate outputs and then think about it and then review whether the problem is solved. So you're not really thinking, strictly thinking about things in a deeper way. You're adding more runtime compute to try to get at the kind of the ultimate problem. It's you always have to go and break things down to the effectively like the simplest possible steps in order to hope to even get a good solution for sophisticated problems. So
Absolutely. But I mean, that's how everything works, right? Like, I mean, you have to break it down, right? Like, I'm teaching my daughter how to ride a bike right now, and you don't tell her, you go step by step by step through the process and help them master each individual step. It's the same thing when you're training a dog, right? You train a dog. You see it do this really complex trick, right? Like, you don't teach it the trick all at once. You break it down into small pieces and you teach, all right, now you're gonna run out and go touch this spot. And then you master that. And when you touch that spot, you turn around. Now you go and now you teach it you step by step by step by step by step, right? I think that that's how we all think about large problems, is you break it down into small steps and you take each small step at a time. But understanding that that's how these systems operate as well is super helpful. Just out of curiosity, do you know why output from these systems is so expensive? Like, where are the bottlenecks?
yeah, so that is great. I will say that I have not actually properly trained a lot of these systems, and we can talk about why that is. So, as you've correctly acknowledged, Nick, usually the most expensive component of working with these LLM providers is actually the output tokens, right? So if you look at their cost, and I think last I checked, something like OpenAI is for, I think it's for o1, but for all their models, right, it's something like $15 for a million output tokens, which is really, really expensive, and you go through those relatively quickly. The answer is that the generation itself is expensive, right? So you have to go and run through the inference process, and usually, again, like we mentioned, it's one token at a time, right? So think about it has to go and run sequentially. But even for organizations that are more cost-minded, again, it's important to that also relates to what we mentioned earlier, in which it's important to keep up to date with where the community is, because there is a continuous tug and pull between all of these providers, which are usually much more expensive. So in particular, OpenAI and Anthropic are amongst the more expensive, and then a lot more of the cheaper providers. You have open source like DeepSeek, Mistral, the Llamas of the world, right? And really, it's always a trade-off, right? Because you pay for convenience in many of those cases when you go and you run against one of these providers. You pay for convenience, and this is even before we went into the eternal question on whether to actually use one of these APIs versus self-host, which was itself it the answer is always it depends. But long story short, that's a key aspect of staying up to date with things, because there's just so many moving parts in terms of cost and performance that and it changes on, I want to say, on a weekly basis, but probably more so than that. So you might run into moments where you have a clear competitive advantage for one provider or another. For any like system architects or system designers in the crowd, that is a very strong recommendation for setting up your systems in ways where you would avoid vendor lock for exactly that reason. Because
Absolutely.
if you put all your eggs in one basket for one particular vendor, you could end up being stuck chained to that vendor for whoever knows how long.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And having the ability to switch is absolutely super important. I think one thing to consider that you didn't mention in that, but I think is an excellent point, is understanding where all your data goes, right? So, yeah, especially for folks that like you and I, who happen to work in let's just say more sensitive spaces, or folks that are working with internal proprietary company data. First, your proprietary company data should never be in one of these systems, right? Second, DeepSeek tracks everything. All these systems, all not just DeepSeek, but every system tracks every single thing. And when I say that, I mean every input, every output, all of it is tracked and held by them. And are you prepared? Like, where, who do you want to have that data? Like, do you want it to be hosted here in the US? Do you want it to be hosted overseas somewhere? You want to be handing it to foreign government, which it can, depending on the system and depending on who has it, right? So bear all that in mind and just be conscientious of it as you go through vendor selection. Like, sometimes the cheapest option isn't actually the cheapest, right? Just because they're going to charge you less dollars doesn't mean it's not going to cost you more in the end.
Yeah, I think that is a really great point, and thank you for bringing it up, Nick. Goes without saying, so first things first, and I guess that just to highlight what you mentioned, we are actually forbidden from using DeepSeek for exactly the reason that you mentioned, and a lot of practitioners who are involved with the government in some ways, there are very clear limitations on which models you can use, and that is a challenge in itself, given that we're I mean, and again, that is also a whole topic in itself, right? Seeing like the essentially the race between us and the Chinese on the space. I will say one last point on it. I will say there's something a little bit ironic on a lot of these Chinese providers actually coming out with and contributing to the open source community in many cases a lot more than like the OpenAIs and Anthropic and the like. A good standalone example, I think, is Llama, which is obviously again Facebook, but doesn't matter. So just goes without saying, to highlight your point clearly, is if you're looking to settle on a provider, make sure you have a very clear understanding of the specific contract and the specific aspects of your collaboration. We use Azure in particular, and we use OpenAI through Azure. And we have a specific agreement in which OpenAI acknowledges that they're not allowed to use our data for training purposes. So it's purely an inference endpoint, right? So that said, anybody is a lay person. If you interact with LLMs, expect your conversations to make it to some training set somewhere.
Absolutely. No,
Goes without saying.
I find it fascinating as you start looking at these systems and figuring out how they're working in real time. So Obviously, the Chinese government has a lot of opinions about things like Tiananmen Square and Taiwan and others. Those are just two. But when DeepSeek first came out, I went on and started obviously under a, I didn't give him my information. I gave him a dummy email that I used. But like you go in and I started asking them like, what happened at Tiananmen Square, right? And the really interesting thing is they were figuring out how to censor it in real time. So you would actually see it would write an answer for you based on reality, and then that answer would disappear, and the new answer would get generated right there, which is like things like, again, fascinating, super cool to watch. Like, I mean, less cool watching them figure out how to decide what information people are allowed to have, but cool to watch them figure out how to work with these systems in real time.
For sure.
You
Yeah, I mean,
know?
if there's one thing that I can commend, I think in particular Grok for, is the fact that it's uncensored, right? So, you mentioned that type of Chinese government censorship, and it goes without saying that certainly, like DeepSeek and Qwen and a lot of the Chinese models, obviously, just if you as a user expect them to be more heavily censored, goes without saying. But there's also censorship on our end as well, although it's much more often oriented towards preventing kind of like offending output from coming from these systems. So, I mean, everybody feel free to pick your poison. So.
Yeah. Or you can just download a, I mean, I don't know if you can run an air gap system that's uncensored, that's downloaded off a Hugging Face and built that way. But like, I don't know. Somebody might be able to tell me if that's a doable thing, right, Daniel?
I don't foresee what I'm sure. Again, and I've never used Grok, and I'm not advertising it, but I'd say the one strength of it, from what I've heard, is again is that it's not censored. But again, a lot of these, I mean, there are additional models that are not. Just go in and read up, do a quick Google search on whatever it is that you want to use, and you should be fine.
Yeah, man. Just out of curiosity, if you had to, for folks that are listening, if you had to recommend one habit or a couple of habits that folks have that you would say are key for developing and maintaining relevancy with AI, what are they, man? Like, because when I think about this, and I think about it, like it's changing fast. I think the speed of the rate of change is going to continue to accelerate in a lot of areas, especially as you look at implementing in all these different areas. So, like from a skills perspective, what should we as users, power users, users, end users, or practitioners be doing on a weekly basis to ensure that we stay up with this?
Yeah, I think, and we were hinting at it a little bit earlier, right? But let's try to come up with a template, right, for how to keep up to date, right? Is my recommendation is dedicate structured time, right, as much as you can, right, and as much as maybe as your employer will permit, and or in many places, I'm fortunate enough to be in a place where that's encouraged, right. Encouraged to give you time to dedicate to staying up to date with what happens in the community, to time for experimentation directly with different types of proofs of concepts. Again, even if you can block out a couple of hours a week, right, just to get a decent amount of time to understand where things are. I think that would do people a lot of great due diligence. If you want to work with other people, do things like set up learning groups and work on different proofs of concepts together. That often helps out a lot. But yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, and that relates maybe to keeping mentally acute more broadly, right? I mean, ultimately, we're and I'd say that to some degree there's something that is a little bit terrifying about it a bit, because you mentioned the rate of change, right? So it's as if we're continuously on a treadmill that's pushing us the other way, right? And you have to keep walking slash running against it, right? To make sure, or even to kind of like stay where you're at. And it's a similar thing ultimately to going and exercising the rest of your muscles when you go to the gym, right? So it's the same kind of concept.
Absolutely, man. Daniel, I have one more question for you. Last one. It's one you didn't get the
Sure.
opportunity to prepare for.
Okay.
If you think about the last 12 months, what's one AI breakthrough that you think is massively underappreciated and why?
Yeah, this one is interesting. And again, there are a lot. So,
You get one.
I know. Had we had this conversation, I don't know, like a month and a half ago or something, or 2 months ago, I would have said something like, again, like MCP, like that would be what I wanted to talk, what I would want to talk to. But I can't use it anymore because now it's all over the place. So it was one of these cases where there was a the idea came out and people were pretty excited and then kind of died down and now it's all over the place. Funnily enough, kind of like AI more broadly, just for those users, and I'm not going to go into a history lesson, but the perceptron, right, is actually from the 50s, right? So AI in itself went through ebbs and flows and went through two very clear periods of what they call AI winters from its inception, right? And now I think we're on the final upswing, right? But again, putting that aside, so what do I think is a really cool implementation, which okay, I have one for you. So something that I'm really excited about and unfortunately hasn't seemed to have been fully utilized even by myself and some of my colleagues is actually better and more structured kind of like prompt engineering. I'd say one of the core components of properly interacting with this type of system, again, is you have to go through properly fine-tuning your prompt and essentially messing around with the system and that is as you and any software professionals can tell, it's that is a pretty tedious thing. It's a pretty tedious and I'd say it's insecure and problematic, right? There are some approaches now with Pydantic and OpenAI has structured outputs, but doesn't matter. It's an area that is being developed. But in particular, there was a project that I got really interested in called the DSPY, which is a project from Stanford that essentially attempts to properly optimize empirically, right? To properly optimize prompts and essentially try to modify prompting or replace prompting by software engineering or writing code, which is great and is certainly where we need to be going. I really applaud, and this is something that people can look up, but I really applaud in particular both, I mean, obviously the DSPY team in Stanford, but I guess as a corollary to that, the small agents team in Hugging Face for implementing code agents as opposed to the standard agent implementation, which just goes and fires around like JSON blobs and hopes that everything works fine type of thing. So I, as a software professional, I don't like prompts. I like code, right? So the more we can use structured code to interact with these types of systems, the more mature and safe and reliable they will be as components in larger software solutions. And at this point, the current state where very often you have to deal with we have to deal with a lot of try and accept handling, and you have to retry and deal with failure cases and all that kind of stuff is that shows pretty clearly that we're still very early in the life cycle for this technology and hopefully we'll be able to move forward there. So
Yeah, man. I really appreciate it, Daniel. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on a Robots and Red Tape today. It's been a great time, man. I really greatly enjoyed our conversation.
me too, Nick. And I again, obviously on a personal level, you know that I have a lot of appreciation for you and I loved our communication over the last couple of weeks slash months and yeah and This is really important, the work that you're doing here with this podcast. I hope that the listeners found at least some of our conversation valuable on, again, on a personal level. I had a great time speaking with you, and yeah, and I can't wait to keep up to date with keep up to date, like we mentioned earlier,
Yeah, man.
right? With all the cool stuff you'll be up with. So thank
Really
you.
appreciate it, man. Thank you. Thank you so much again. And everybody, thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I'm Nick Schutt signing off. Have a good day.